Well, thank you very much for a lovely and most generous introduction. I'm reminded of the fact that, you know, when you said that about the professor, that about putting people to sleep, that when my parents lived in Europe and I came here to the United States after the war, and my parents weren't that sure about Jewish education, you know. It was easy for me to tell them when I got an F in high school that it stood for fantastic. And so I went to graduate school and I got a PhD in sociology. And I remember, it's most appropriate that I say this here in a synagogue or shul, that, you know, I told my mother, I said, you know, I got a PhD. What do you think about that? She says, well, when you'll be a rabbi, then I'll brag. She says, until now, forget it. My father, on the other hand, was a man who survived the war, so he was a person who knew how to adjust to life. And for a long time, he was asking me, what do sociologists do? And, you know, when I told him they study people, of course, he thought to himself, well, he's in business. He gets about 2 minutes to study somebody, and then he has to make a decision. Why do you have to give a degree for this? But he didn't say anything. And then I noticed after I got the PhD, then he thought it was a great thing because he was an expert in cognitive dissonance. And he saw that I had this degree. He told me, you know, I was reading an article in the Sunday Times magazine about urban problems, and I see the sociologists, they're the most important people in the world. So, you know, obviously, he had it a little reversed. First I got the degree, then he thought it was important, but that's okay. Now, you know, as you're introducing me and you repeated the title of the talk, should I send my son to Lakewood, Harvard, and YU, I thought to myself, well, what if you went to all three? What would that be like? You know, after all, it's a free world, and you could go wherever you want to, and in a sense, I'm not going to talk about anything that I wrote, but you know, in terms of a resume. But the fact is that in my own life, I'm a hybrid of all these places, and for that reason, I do feel equipped to discuss them. And I want to leave time to answer a question. How much time do we have? What time does the session end? No one knows. 10:15. Okay. And I went to Manhattan Day School, which was a modern Orthodox institution on the west side of Manhattan, a co-ed school that preached the values of modern Orthodoxy, Zionism, etc. Then I went to MTA, Manhattan Talmudical Academy. During the summer, I went to Camp Monk, which was a right-of-center camp. Why would my father send me to Manhattan Day School and Camp Monk? I mean, these two didn't go together. When you grew up, you know, in the sociography, if you will, or the ethnography of New York or the United States, if you went to Manhattan Day School, then you went to a camp called Maple Lake, or you went to, Highline or something like that. And if you went to Camp Monk, then that meant that during the year you went to a yeshiva like Yeshiva of Eastern Parkway or Torah Semes in Borough Park. A lot of people are hybrid people. I see Rabbi Blau is here this morning. Unbeknownst to him, you know, he's now a very, very prominent figure at Yeshiva University, and he's a Mashkiach Ruchani. But unbeknownst to him, my wife remembers him as the B'nai Akiva leader in Borough Park. So, you know, you can go through a lot of transformations in this world. And unlike the Hindus, we don't wait to die. You know, we do it in one lifetime. So my father sent me to Manhattan Day School and Camp Monk because he heard that Manhattan Day School was a good school, and he heard Camp Monk was a good camp. And the idea of symmetry, which is what we're going to discuss this morning, didn't really figure in his great plans. And everything has an impact. Whatever institution you send your child to is going to have an effect. For example, here I was going to Camp Monk, and I was at Manhattan Talmudical Academy, MTA, actually MTI, and because it was divided into two divisions. And in the summer, a counselor, who I believe was Canadian, I don't know if he came from Toronto or Montreal, but he might have come from here. His name was Fievel Mueller. Does that name ring a... Oh, he's from Montreal. Okay, so he's from another place where they speak a different language. But he... Pardon me? Well, that's what happened, you see. Because he was in Mary Yisrael with me and wanted that to happen, he convinced me to leave MTA and go to Mary Yisrael. But I didn't like it so much, for which I wrote a book about it, actually. And I left, and I went then to Kamenitz and the Sifta of Borough Park, the pronunciation of which would earn you at least, I should think, a high school diploma, if you could pronounce such a long name. And then I went to Yeshiva College, where I was in REITs for one semester, now known as the YP program. And then, owing to the fact that they put me in a shir, which I didn't like, I transferred to TI, Teachers Institute, where, thank God, I learned Hebrew and rounded out my education or miseducation, as whatever you wish to call it. Then I went to Washington University in St. Louis. I received my PhD there. My first job was at Georgia State University in Atlanta. And then my next job was at Yale University, teaching in the sociology department and the Afro-American Studies department. How I ended up there, I don't know. And then I came to City University, where I have been ever since. I'm at the Graduate Center and at City College of New York. So at least I could say I experienced all different types of Jewish education, right, left, center, and all sorts of variations within that framework. But I would tell you that, you know, when the title of the talk is, should I send my son to Lakewood, Harvard, or YU, the emphasis is really on the wrong word. The emphasis, you know, can be on Lakewood, Harvard, and YU, but the real emphasis should be, should I, underline the word I, or we, send our son, and the emphasis should be on the word son. Because the first and foremost principle in this matter is that you have to know your child. There is no such thing as a proper institution for your child. There is such a thing as a proper institution for your child. And parents always know their children, but they often confuse their children with themselves. And that's where we make our biggest error. There is this feeling, especially, you know, when people wake up one morning at some point in their lives and they realize that they're not going to conquer the entire world, that they're not going to have the dream life that they always envisioned for themselves, the next phase begins. And that phase is going to be, I'm going to live on through my children. The problem is when we apply that too forcefully, we are capable and prone to making errors. So first, what do you have to know about your child? Well, if we're talking about the Orthodox community, you have to know your child religiously. Some people need to be pushed to go to Minyan. Other people are the embodiment of Zerizim Makdimim LeMitzvot, and they find that they don't have to do anything. Their child loves religion. And you have to know where your child is located in this area. And in that way, you can tell whether or not they'll benefit from one or another form of education. You have to know where your child is intellectually. You know, the idea of 1,000 go in and how many come out is very, very apropos here. The fact of the matter is, if your child is not intellectually inclined, I'm talking about religious education here. If we're talking about sending your kid to Neir Yisrael or Telz or Lakewood or Mira or Torah Vadas or any one of these yeshivas, you're making a big mistake. You're making a big mistake. The only thing you're going to benefit from is you're going to be able to come to shul or bar mitzvahs and tell everybody your child goes to Lakewood. The problem is your child is only going to go to Lakewood, but he's not going to learn anything at Lakewood. And you and most of all your child will be the loser for it. So that's not a path to go down. To put your child in an environment that is an unhappy environment for the child simply because it looks good on the resume is obviously the biggest mistake. So if it's so obvious, how come people do it? Because people often lead with their emotions and follow only with their brain in terms of thinking. And I can only tell you, I've heard so many stories of children who are unhappy, who feel out of place. I mean, this doesn't just hold true in Lakewood. This holds true anywhere. I remember when I taught at Yale, I had a student a black student who came from Chicago. He was one of the early beneficiaries of affirmative action. And I was teaching a course in urban theory. It was a difficult course. And he did not understand what was being said in class. And he would come up to me, and he would say, "Professor, could you tell me again what you said?" And I would tell him. And no matter how hard I tried to tell him, it did not penetrate. You know, if someone doesn't get it, you can repeat it 100 times. It doesn't really matter. And this, by the way, applies in so many, so many cases. I remember when my wife and I visited Poland in the 1970s to look at the concentration camps and to look at the cities there. I found that, I'm sure you've had this experience, people would start talking to me in Polish, and I don't know Polish. And when I didn't respond with alacrity, they would say it again, but this time a little louder. And the third time, even louder. And I kept telling them, I said to my wife, "What's the matter with these people? They think if they scream the language at me, I will understand it more quickly." So if you don't understand it, you're not going to understand it. Now, this student was a very, very, very unhappy young man. He went through the entire semester. He got a D in the course, and believe me, that was 60% more than he deserved, because he didn't know anything. And he dropped out. He was doing poorly in his other classes. And the saddest thing that he said to me was, "My high school didn't prepare me for Yale." I said, "So how did you end up here?" He said, "They were looking for black students. I got the highest grades in my school, but it was a very bad school. It wasn't a good school." So here he sat, and he was ashamed of himself. His dignity was erased. His ego was greatly diminished, and he benefited nothing from it. And by the way, lest you think in racial terms, let me assure you that I had another student, I still remember his name, it was Theodore Seals, who came from that same city, who got an A-plus in the course, and he was black too. So it's not just a question of the fact that he was black, it's a question of who he was. You know, I can show you children from deprived backgrounds in Appalachia will be sent to Harvard, will do just as poorly, and they're white. I mean, I often think, because I teach race and ethnic relations, when you talk about white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, the presumably privileged class of WASPdom. So, people who grew up in the hollers of West Virginia are also WASP. What's their excuse? They've been here 200 years. They're going to claim that they were discriminated against racially? Now, that's intellectually. Socially, you need to know where your child is socially. Some children will flourish in an environment that is highly competitive socially. They're the ones who are always the most popular in their class. They're the ones who are president or vice president of their GO, of their general student organization. And they do well in atmospheres where there is a highly social competitive element. But if your child's not that kind of child, then be very, very careful. Don't try to send your child where the cool kids are if your child isn't cool, whatever cool means. We could spend 2 hours discussing how cool is arrived at as a defining term and a way of excluding others. But the fact of the matter is that you have to know the social environment. Plus, you have to know who your child is going to that school with. You also have to know how prone your child is to being influenced by other people in his or her immediate social environment. I only use his as a general term. Obviously, everything I say applies equally, though perhaps sometimes differently, to women. Health. You have to know about your child's health. You have to know your child's mental health. You have to know if your child is obsessive-compulsive, if your child is prone to depression, if your child is hyperactive. Aside from medication, aside from knowing if there are mental health professionals in either the school or the environment to help your child, you have to know how much stress your child can tolerate. Do you want your child in a place where he or she can come home every 2 weeks, every evening, or once every 3 months? These are things that you must take into account. And again, that's why I begin this talk with saying the emphasis is on your child. If you don't know your child, then find out about your child. But don't send your child anywhere until you know exactly what your child is all about. Which, by the way, involves listening to your child. In other words, I had a woman who told me the other day that her daughter, who is a senior at a coordinate school, you know, it's different. Coordinate is not always the same as co-ed. I mean, YU is coordinate. It has Stern College and it has and it has Yeshiva College. Then there are co-ed schools where the classes are all together for all classes. There are benefits and disadvantages of that. And then there are schools which are separate classes, but they can go out together for lunch down the block. In other words, they're co-ed for lunch, but they're separate for all classes. I made the comment the other day that the whole thing is rather ridiculous because how much socializing are you going to do in the class anyway? Now, this particular child told her mother as she is now a senior, she said, "Mom, I only want to go to a college where there are religious girls, and I want to go to one that's close to home. I'm not interested in being a pioneer. I'm not interested in being exposed to irreligious girls. I just want to be with religious girls. That's me. That's who I am." That mother would do well to listen to her child and not to try to force her own more ecumenical values upon her. But it really depends. You know, you can push your child in any direction, but that doesn't mean your child's going to go that way. We have the saying, Chanoch l'nar al pi darko. There is nothing more true about this talk than Chanoch l'nar al pi darko. And in other words, educate the child according to the child's inclination. For example, I know a case where a child went to an Ivy League college, and then the parents wanted the child to go to law school. So the child, to make the parents happy, went to law school and is then now poised to enter the world of corporate law. The problem is the child is an intellectual and doesn't want to go into corporate law. So the child has now told his parents that he is going to pursue a PhD degree in philosophy or political theory or something like that. So the parent thinks, well, gee, you know, this law school education costs $100,000, and if this child would only smarten up, wise up, and wake up and smell the coffee, they could be making $180,000 a year as a corporate attorney. But the child doesn't want to be a corporate attorney, so what good does it do? So yeah, you have to understand that you'll send your child down a path that you want to be a frum learner, and then the child will announce that he doesn't want to be a frum learner. Now, that's not to say that there aren't long-term effects. If I can at least say this, I wrote a book called The World of the Yeshiva, and I studied yeshiva graduates, and we did a very large random sample of graduates of Ne'er Yisrael Yeshiva in Baltimore. And we found that something like 90% of them learn Gemara several times a week, many of them every day. So if you want your child to be what they call Koveya Ichim, you know, to learn and study all the time, it's certainly a good bet that if you send them there, that that's going to be an outcome. But again, you don't know. Some people need to be given space. Other people need to have their space reduced. You have to know, again, what your child is likely to be like. So all this, it goes without saying, has to do with the parents, too. I can understand the feelings of a parent who feels terrible that their child doesn't want to be observant. But I think here, you see, you have to understand that with some children, if you want your child to be very frum, the worst thing you can do is force them. With other children, the worst thing you can do is tell them, do whatever you want. Again, you have to know your child. Some children will come right back at you and say, are you telling me to go to the left so that I'll really go to the right? Is that your game? So, you know, it's not good to try to outsmart your children. It's better to try to deal with the situation as a real human being and just to try and go with the flow and let's see what happens to them. I now know of a case, I get involved in a lot of these things somehow. In the non-academic bio, I was president of my children's day school, which is located in Great Neck, Long Island, for 5 years, and I've been an officer of the school for 20 years, and I'm now a consultant to the school. And the school goes from toddler through high school. So I've had a lot of personal experience now. As I said, I'll be happy to answer any questions that I hope I can answer that you might have. We have now a case of a father who is of a Sephardic background and who believes in being very strict with his children. And he has a daughter who's rebellious. The daughter doesn't want to be religious. The daughter's only a fresh person. Is that the right term? I want to be politically correct. I'm just joking. There's only a freshman in high school. And the child is driving him crazy, as he says. So maybe if the child's driving him crazy, he should go to the therapist. But he hasn't done that yet. He sent his child to the therapist, but he only wanted a therapist with an Orthodox background. Was it so that the child could so that the therapist could understand the child better? I presume so. But that's not really why. He said to me, look, he says, I have a certain outcome that I want here. And that outcome is I want the therapist to tell my child that she has to be Orthodox. I said, you consider this a therapeutic problem? What if the child isn't happy being Orthodox? What if the child doesn't want to be like you want the child to be? What do you want then? Well, I want her to be Orthodox anyway, because that's the way I raised her. And we made all this effort. What's wrong with the life we're leading? And I said to him, there's nothing wrong with the life you're leading. If your child doesn't agree with you, it doesn't mean it's wrong. Like I do, I have a market research company. I do focus groups. The first thing I tell the people when we go around the room is I say there's no such thing as a right or wrong answer. It has to do with how you feel about it. And in this particular case, though, we would love to believe that the values of Yiddishkeit that we imparted to our children are the true and correct values. We must allow for the fact that in this world there are people who don't agree with us. Whenever there's a self-congratulatory tone to Orthodoxy about how wonderful it is, the Baal Tshuva movement and how many people became frum, I am at pains to remind Orthodox Jews that they are but 5% of the market in North America. They're 5% of the population. 95% of Jews in America are not Orthodox. And that isn't because they don't know about Orthodoxy. That's because they're not buying. So in a free and open society, we haven't done that well. We've only been able to persuade 5%. That's a very bad percentage that what we believe in is correct. Now, that may be for all sorts of reasons that I certainly don't want to affix blame for. I mean, we don't make it easy to be Orthodox. I remember one time I went to a talk given by a Reconstructionist rabbi. And I asked the rabbi at the end, I said, just jokingly, I said, if your movement is so good, how come there's so few of you? I never forgot the answer. The answer was, Reconstructionism isn't for everybody. Okay. And Orthodox Judaism isn't for everybody. We don't have to feel guilty about the fact that we don't have that many people. What we believe in is, it's tough to believe in it. But we got there. But that doesn't mean that we can make our children go there. And remember one thing. Your children will only be in your house for a certain number of years. If you want them to spend the rest of their life on the therapist's couch explaining why they hated what you did to them, go ahead. You're welcome. It's your decision. And as they say, it's your funeral. Now, what kind of outcome do you want when you send your child to an institution? Well, let's face it. This is a classic case. You know, people are always saying, I don't want my child to go to this school because I don't want my child to be exposed to bad influences. Understood. You know, you have every right. You have every right to say that. And by the way, you're right, to some extent. You're right that it follows like this. If you want your child to learn Lishma about Shakespeare, about Thomas Aquinas, about history in general, about science, that's fine. But please understand one thing. You have to decide, you must know that if you send your child into an environment that's not religious, you're going to be taking a chance. You must know that you are taking a chance. The question is, how important is the benefit compared to the risk? And that is a decision that only you can make. No one can make this decision for you. The only thing that you can do is be better informed about the risks and the benefits. And I will discuss how you can do that. But the point is, you must understand that if you send your child to Harvard, your child has a much better chance of not being religious than if you send your child to YU. Of course you'll find yechidim at YU who are not religious, and of course you'll find plenty of people who went to Harvard who are, but I'm a sociologist, not a psychologist. Go with the odds. The odds are that if you send your child to a non-Jewish school, basically, there is a percentage chance. Now, some people will say that if I send my child to Yale, or shall we say, University of Arizona, and my child is still frum, that's worth a lot more than if I kept my child locked up behind the transparent walls of Borough Park and made sure that they were frum. What's the accomplishment? I mean, they're going to say if you brainwash somebody and teach them only this way, of course they're going to stay in the community, except for exceptions who flee into the night. But basically, that's what's going to happen. Whereas if I send my child to an environment that's not religious and he's still religious, then his religion is worth more than the other person because it's based on conviction and not socialization. You're right, but it's your call. You just have to know the call you're making and the call you may receive from your children someday. So you really have to think about it carefully. Now, is there a risk that your child will be not religious in University of Michigan? Yes. McGill University? Yes. But also remember that there are risks when you send your child to Lakewood, and you have to decide if those risks are pleasing to you too. There's the risk that your child will say, I don't want to do a stitch of work for the rest of my life. I just want to learn. Is that what you want? Fine. Then you send your child to Lakewood. But remember, there is that risk that your child will say, it is not ennobling to work. I don't care what Rabbi Yochanan Sandler did. I don't want to work. I want to learn all the time. I want to marry a rich girl and sit and learn all the time. Or your child will say, I don't think it's immoral to steal from the government because there are people who are stealing from the government in yeshivas. And I'm not telling any tales out of school here to tell you that there are people in the frum world who justify stealing from the government as something that is correct to do because it fulfills the higher goal of learning Torah. And your child will therefore go into a world that has certain values among segments of it, not all of it. There are a lot of people in the yeshiva world who condemn that. But there will be people there who will not buy into it, and your child might be exposed to those values and come home with them. Or your child might come home and say, you're not religious because you don't cover your hair. Or I can't eat in your house. Or I don't even want to come home for Sukkot because I'd rather spend it with the Rosh Yeshiva. Those are all things that can happen if you send your child to a right-wing yeshiva. And you'll have nobody to blame but yourself if you didn't find out first. But on the other hand, if that's what you want, then you should do it. If you consider, you know, look, I have a cousin in Israel. And he told me that that I would be crazy to say to him, he says to me, you would send your children to the army? What are the signs I see in Meir Sharim that say Nazionist? N-A-Z-I-O-N-I-S-T. Nazionist. Say, what is that? I said, and I see a swastika and an equal sign and a mug and David scrawled in graffiti on the wall. I said to myself, is this just a figment of my imagination? I said, tell me, Binyamin, do you really believe that the Nazis and the Zionists are the same? He says, in some ways, the Zionists are worse. I said, why? He said to me something that I'm sure will shock you, as it shocked me, but he said, and when he said it, it becomes data. It becomes a fact. Not that it's true. It becomes a fact that he said it. He said to me that the Zionists are worse than the Nazis on one level because the Nazis took the Jews out of Olam Hazeh and the Zionists took them out of Olam Haba. Now, from his perspective, a person who believes that Kol Ha'olam Prozdor, that this world is but a waiting room for the world to come, the 80 years that you spend on this earth are a second in the passage of time. It's far, far more important. You must understand that when you deal with a person who lives entirely in the spiritual world, that affects how they look at the physical world and how they look at the here and now. So please understand that for those of you who do not have this experience, that when you send your child to a very frum yeshiva, you know, hopefully they won't have the attitudes of this person. I'm not saying that he is statistically in the majority. He exists as a minority, There are certainly people like him right in Lakewood. If you don't think so, then I have to tell you, you don't know. But I do know. And there are people like that. And the chances are your child will not end up thinking in that extreme version. Every world has its extremes. Yeshiva world has its extremes. The modern Orthodox world has its extremes. Everything has its extremes, and the extremes are useful primarily in the sense that they define the middle. That's where we need to understand it. Now, chances are your child will go to Lakewood, be a nice guy, be from whatever opinions he has about this, he'll keep to himself, if he indeed has them. But you must understand that your child is going to enter a world that is fundamentally different from the world that's out there in the regular working world. Whether you're right of center, center, a little bit right of center, modern Orthodox, centrist Orthodox, reasonably Orthodox, strictly Orthodox, I don't know, whatever terms you want to call yourself, doesn't really matter. Now, Lakewood today is less elitist in one sense than it was. The time was in the 1950s, early 1960s, you went to Lakewood, 300 people went to Lakewood, 200 people, you know, in the time of 1962, I think that was the year that Rav Aaron Kuffler Zatzal was Nifter. In those days, it was a small yeshiva. And even in Europe, as you know, the elite went to these advanced yeshivas. Today, I call it the proletarianization of the yeshiva. Today, everybody can go. Not everybody can go to Lakewood, though. You have to take an entrance exam. They don't just let anybody in because, you know, I happen to be in the neighborhood. And, you know, I don't like Bricktown, so I'm coming to Lakewood. But Lakewood is still an elite yeshiva. But it is not as elite as before. The yeshiva today is populated by many, many more Hasidim than was the case. And the interesting thing is that yeshivas were founded on the Lithuanian model. And the Lithuanian model is the model that they more or less adopted and stayed with. But the population is mostly Hungarian and Polish. Those are the people who go. You don't find too many Litvaks age 19 studying in yeshivas today because they either became, you know, apikorsen or, you know, they're not around anymore. You know, the Rosh Yeshivas, the Alta from Slobodka was a Litvak. Now, here's the problem. What happens? You want your child to go to Lakewood. You want your child to be a learner. And he's not good enough to go to Lakewood. They have to go to another yeshiva. So then you have other yeshivas. You know, obviously at or near the level of places like Baltimore or Torah Tamima in Brooklyn or whatever. You know, there are very good yeshivas. The problem is that there are many yeshivas that are for what will be derogatorily referred to as also-rans. It's people who are good. But the problem is that if you apply to go to the Ivy League and you don't get in, but you go to Brandeis, nope. Brandeis is ranked, according to the U.S. News and World Report, 30th in the country. Not Vishkefela. You know, you get in, you're a little better. So you went to the University of Michigan. Michigan is ranked, I think, 22nd or something like that. But no, Wisconsin is 22nd. Michigan's a little higher. Okay, you go to Tufts. You go to University of Indiana. You can go to the University of Toronto, fine, fine university. You can go to McGill, fine school. So you have a whole range of schools to go to where you can still feel good that your child is going somewhere at least a little bit mechubedek. But in the yeshivas, if they have not figured out how to make the children who go to so-called average yeshivas feel good about themselves, they feel like they're losers. The reason is that the yeshiva values learning to such an extreme. And while it gives lip service to the idea that if you're a palace guard, in other words, you brought the Rosh Yeshiva his coffee and you drove him everywhere, or let's go to another level, you were a masmid, you tried very hard, or let's go to another level, you were a balmidos, and you were very good to people, and you never said lashon hara. But somehow in the back of everybody's mind is the feeling that that's not really where it's at. Where it's at, and the guy who gets the best shidduch, is the guy who really knew half the shots by the time he was 22. Where does this leave the rest of the people? This problem is exacerbated by the large family size in the right-wing community, where people have so many children that, listen, if you have 9, 10 children, you think all of them are going to be Gemara cups? They're not. Some are not going to be. And what's going to happen to them? You, And the yeshivas have to be able to make them feel a sense of accomplishment, a sense of self-worth, have to be able to make them feel good about themselves. And how do we do that in an environment where this doesn't have the social psychological support system from the people who run the very institutions? I mean, I said to Rabbi Neuberger of Mary Yisrael when I interviewed him, I said to him, tell me, Rabbi Neuberger, why are you taking in people who are not really going to make it that well in this yeshiva world? He says, we do not have the right to decide at the beginning of a person's career in learning who's going to make it and who's not going to make it. And that is true. We don't, because, you know, people, one of the most important things in this whole discussion is that children will be in one place one day and another place another day. They may start out, you know, it's like when you go to watch the races, which I'm sure most of you are not watching the races. I know very few people who go watch the races. At least now that they have off-track betting, they don't have to go anywhere to watch the races. But the point is, when you go to watch the races, some horses start out fast, end up last. Some horses start out last, end up first. The race of life isn't over till it's over, till your child's an adult. And therefore, you don't know what's going to happen to your child. So how do we, in fact, make this judgment? And that is very, very difficult. What we have to have is an alternate plan in case they don't make it. Now, you know, I had a son. When I was doing interviews of all these Rosh Yeshivas, and I had the opportunity, I should say, the schus, to interview Rav Huttner, Rav Gifter, Rav Rudeman, Rav Kamenetsky, Rav Cutler, Rav Schneer Cutler, Rav... No, I interviewed all the major Rosh Yeshivas in the constellation of the yeshiva world. And I learned a lot from interviewing them. I had a son who played the piano at the age of 2.5. He gave his first concert at 4. He was playing Mozart at 3. He was truly a person with perfect pitch, and he was a guttle in music. So I figured, I'm doing all these interviews with these Rosh Yeshivas, I have an opportunity to ask him his opinion. You know, let me get something else out of this besides writing the book. Maybe I'll get a little advice about how to deal with my child. So I said, what do I do with my child? He's playing piano 7 hours a day. And most of the Rosh Yeshivas said, you got to give him a good chinuch. You got to, like, give him good education. And I said, fine. But one Rosh Yeshiva, it was Rav Huttner of Chaim Berlin, said to me, this child you should not take away from the piano. Let him play the piano. Yes, Gemara, no Gemara, let him play the piano, because if you don't, you're going to ruin him, because that's his inclination. And from there, you could see the importance of Chanoch. And by the way, it turned out fine. He's not a piano player. He's doing very well, but he's not in the area of music. You know, teachers have to chase him around the room holding out melting ice creams to get him to come back to the piano. He didn't want to learn formally. That's the way it is. Now, I see that I only have 5 or 7 minutes left because I want to take some questions, so I'm going to run through some other things. When it comes to yeshivas, whether it's the standard yeshivas of Chaim Berlin or Mira or Torah Vadas, or whether it's the newer yeshivas that are located in such esoteric places as South Fallsburg, Passaic, Scranton, you know, it's like the yeshivas in Europe, you know, Baranovich, you know, these places were hick towns, but to us, on our map, they're wonderful big places because big yeshivas were there. Why you? Well, I'm sorry, I only have 5-7 minutes to talk about YU, but and the other colleges, but let me say this. YU has moved significantly to the right, but the modern Orthodox element is still present and is still strong there. And it's really the only place for it. Yes, you can go to Yeshiva Chovevei Torah if you want to get smicha and you want to get it in a with a more liberal cast to it, but basically, YU is still the place for modern Orthodox Jews. But you have to remember something about YU. YU today, it gets federal funds, is not the place it was 20, 30 years ago. You can be gay, you can be openly gay, and go to YU, and nobody can throw you out. In fact, a gay student ran for student council president until a coalition defeated him. You can be irreligious. You can take off the yarmulke in a secular class in the afternoon and say you're a Sephardic Jew, and they're not going to do anything to you. But again, those are the exceptions. Predominantly, first of all, go visit YU. You can count up, you can stand on the corner, and you can do a statistical count. How many black hats and velvet yarmulkes did you see, and how many kipas frugot did you see, and what time it is? Of course, you have to know where to stand, because it depends when the classes get out, because different people are taking different classes at different times. But like everywhere else, the middle has largely disappeared. You're either to the left or you're to the right, whatever. Rabbis Goldbicht and Reichman are not Rabbis Willig and Kahn. The Rosh Yeshivas are different. They go all the way along the continuum, and you just have to know who's who. So with YU, it depends where you hang out. It depends what division you're in. It's a very complex place, as witness the fact that the type of candidates for the presidency of YU were so different from each other, never mind in general different. And Mr. Richard Joel, why would a mister get the job of being president of a university where they value doctor and rabbi? The reason is because they understood that being a president requires certain skills, that it doesn't matter so much whether you're mister, doctor, or rabbi. It's nice if you are, but you have to be a fundraiser. You have to be a glad hander. You have to be an effective speaker. You have to know the Federation world. You have to know what's going on out there. And he does. And I would say that in the long run, he will make that school into a more modern Orthodox institution, but it will take time, and only time will really tell. YU has never been accepted by the black hat yeshiva world. It's always seen as a paler shade of black. Why? Because as long as it's got a college on its premises, it's not going to be accepted. Besides, there are all sorts of personal reasons why the right-wing yeshiva world hates YU, and none of that is going away so quickly. Now, it's good academically. It's ranked, I think, 40th or 41st in the U.S. News and World Report. But, by the way, that's not the Torah. I'm just citing it as a source. You know, there are other sources for ranking schools, namely your own opinion. But the fact is that it's better for MDs and lawyers and accountants than it is for philosophers and historians. Keep that in mind when you think of what you want to do with your child or what your child wants to do. If you like a beautiful campus, take the train to Columbia. Don't go to YU. It's not a beautiful campus. It's for higher reasons, you know. It's four blocks of buildings, basically. I went there for 4 years. Believe me, I know the campus inside out. If you like Dominicans, it's a wonderful neighborhood, you know. But if you like a beautiful campus with a quad, you know, you'll just have to resort to your imagination. You want to go there. Now, unless you only want to learn, there isn't really a Shabbos scene there. Again, you could go to Columbia for the Shabbos scene. They take people from all over New York. They go there. Now, when it comes to the colleges, I haven't said anything about them. In the remaining time, I'm going to talk about that. You have to know that Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Dartmouth are all very different from each other. Dartmouth is not a place to go to if you want a really, really strong Jewish environment. And Harvard, Yale, Princeton are not like Columbia, which is in New York City. Yale, as you remember, had the whole incident with the Yale 4 in the dormitory, and that they didn't want to be known. I think personally that they were wrong. I don't think you can make Yale into a yeshiva, even if the first letter is the same. It's just not. You know, Yale is Yale. It's a private school. You should know what you're getting into, and if you don't like it, don't go. But don't try to bend the institution to your will any more than a Sikh or a Hindu or a Muslim is going to try to bend it to their will. It's not going to work. And the fact is that even though they had high-priced lawyers, you know, defending them, they lost. And deservedly so. You know, the courts ruled. You can't. Listen, they tried to make accommodations. They tried to give them a separate room, a separate floor, and everything else, but they were out to prove a point. In this, they were abetted, hypocritically, in my opinion, by the Aguda. What does the Aguda care whether kids go to Yale? Yet they took on their case. They took on their case to show the bankruptcy of college in general, which is fine from their perspective, but what does it do for the children who are put through a bad experience? What does it do for all the modern Orthodox children who want to go to Yale and now can't get in there? Because they've been so burnt. And by the way, that applies to Princeton and Brown and the other schools as well. They said, what, are we crazy? We take a person in, they're one of the 2% that gets in, and then they sue us because they don't like their dorm room? Who asked them to come here? You know, it's not like they suddenly discovered that the dorms were co-ed when they got there. Didn't they read the catalog? Now, by the way, when it comes to co-ed dorms and drugs and everything, it's all there. And you have to, again, decide what you want to do. Now, your child will not only be exposed to irreligiosity on the campuses, but they will be exposed to people who are not Jewish. They might intermarry. Your child's going to be exposed to anti-Semitism. Your child is going to be exposed to anti-Zionism like never before. We don't have a friend in the world except for the United States. My son, one of my sons, goes to Rutgers, where there are all sorts of problems. My son got up and asked the question of a Jewish professor by the name of Norman Finkelstein, and he asked him a question about Israel, and he was about one of six Jewish students in this audience of 400 students, most of whom are Palestinians, and they booed him. I said to him, Joseph, why did you ask a question in this forum? He said, I was brought up to be proud of being a Jew, to be proud of being a Zionist. I would have killed myself if I hadn't been able to ask a question like that. I said, how did you feel when you asked the question and they all started booing you? He said, my legs were shaking. I was scared. But he says, I felt I had to do it. But that's the kind of thing you're going to go through. You see, what we have at North Shore Hebrew Academy High School in Great Neck is a prep course called the Jewish Survival Kit for Campuses. In other words, we give our children a course on how to survive on the campus, because that's what they need. Every high school in America, every yeshiva high school in America ought to be giving a course preparing students for college. Now, what do you do then? First of all, I want you to know something. I'm going to go back to one thing before. I don't want to lose it. When you talk about the Israel year, I haven't really touched on it, but the Israel year is the same as anything else. Spend the money, go to Israel, check out the yeshiva you're going to send your kids to, if that's what you want to do. Because you're not really going to know unless you see it in action. But if you can't do that, then there's on the computer, on the internet, you could check out something called OrthodoxCaucus.org. Summaries of all these different yeshivas, and then you can be more informed. Now, similarly, when you send your child to college, you've got to know the following things. You've got to know how many Jewish students are there. Is there a Hillel on campus? Is there a Chabad on campus? Do they get along with each other, which often is no. How does it work? And I will give you a website where you can find the answer to this. Do they have a minyan every day? Do they have kosher meals? Are the kosher meals once a week on Shabbat or Shabbos, depending on your ideological beliefs? Are the kosher meals during the week? Where do the kids come from? What proportion of the kids are from Orthodox backgrounds? Do they have a minyan? What is the male-female ratio among the Jewish students? What's the Jewish studies department like? Can you get credits for having gone to Israel? What is the distance from home you have to evaluate? What is the local Jewish community like? Because it's always changing. It's one of the things you have to know about these colleges is they change. What was true 4 years ago isn't true now. And you can't always tell by going with the numbers. For example, if you send your kid to Brandeis and your kid is modern Orthodox to the point where your daughter wants to wear pants, she's not going to be accepted by most of the Orthodox kids at Brandeis because they're very cliquey. This doesn't come up in the statistics, but it's a fact of life. I know because I've talked to people who've gone there. And when they go there, they're a very insular group. If you didn't learn in Israel and you don't wear a skirt, you're not part of the in-group. So what choice does that leave somebody who's on the left side of modern Orthodoxy? They can only hang out with irreligious people. That's what's going to happen. Same is true, by the way, of Columbia. Columbia has a very strong inner core group of people who consider themselves from. If you don't wear a yarmulke on campus to classes, you're not from. Even a baseball hat won't do it. You have to show you're from. That's what you got to know when you send your kid to college. And the only way you're going to find that out is by talking, and listening, all day long to the people who are sending, half sent. Talk to the graduates, the people who went to these schools. But if you have to know, there is something called the NCSY Guide to Being Observant. And that's on the net. That's on the web. Also, there's www.hillel.com. Turn on www.hillel.com. You'll find out about every college in America that has a significant Jewish presence. You'll even find out that there's a school called Vanderbilt in Tennessee, which has $100 million available for Jewish students. Vanderbilt is ranked in the top 20 schools in the United States. If your child can handle going to a school where your child will be one of only a few Jews, but get an excellent education practically for free, there's a rich Jewish man who went to Vanderbilt who wants it to become a more Jewish place and has endowed a great deal of money so that Jewish kids can go there. And while your child might ordinarily not deserve to get into a school of that ranking, they can go there if they're there. On the other hand, you want to go to Duke like my friend who's a doctor from South Africa, may I add, my friend decided his kid came back with payas from a year in Israel. How Hakotel became payas, I don't know. But anyway, he decided he was going to change Duke. He left there for 2 years. He can't change the world. He came to change Duke. Duke changed him. So don't be such a chacham and think that because your kid is from, you can send him everywhere, because you got to know your kid. All right. Let me just say one final thing, which is this. The most important thing you can do with your children is spend time with them. My father didn't have any money. Every Sunday was reserved for me. He invented a game for me, which was we went on the subway to the last stop and walked around. And there were many subways and many lines, and I had a great time. What I could tell you is, remember, one day your children will be you. It's very important to realize that. So you have to give them love, you have to give them direction, and you have to give them time. If you do all three of those things, you'll be way ahead of the game, and I thank you very much.
I just wanted to ask you, you said 5% of Jews are Orthodox. Where did you get that figure?
And
is it? And is it 10 here? 5 in the U.S. and 10 here?
It's more here because proportions are different. But in the United States, let's put it this way. Nobody, the whole National Jewish Population Study was a fiasco. Nobody knows whether it's 5, 4, 6, or 7. But let me tell you something. If it was 9, we'd be in the same bit of trouble. Shrinking, like a violet. Any other questions? I'll try to answer the questions quickly because we don't have that much time. But okay.
I guess you said a little bit at the beginning that there's differences between men and women, and I think everybody knows that once people start getting out of the educational part of things and getting into the social part of things, the amount of time they spend on learning diminishes drastically. Can you say something about that in terms of what we should do for our sons and for our daughters? We should try and keep them away from socialized situations until they learn what they need to learn, or like ages and all this kind of stuff?
To give you the short answer, women, for all sorts of obvious reasons, are much more vulnerable and therefore have to be, in my opinion, in a more protected environment. But men get into a lot more trouble. You're welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'll have to stop.
So we have 60 seconds, right?
Ladies,
let's try.
60 seconds.
I just don't want to feel as somebody didn't get to ask. I'm sorry.
I have kids all over the map. One of my kids is intellectual, one of my kids is... Not an intellectual, but he's there because of commitment. Like he's there obligation. He's there because of obligation.
Right.
And another kid's there out of love.
Right.
But they're all going in different schools. They're all going in different directions. In my house, there's a balagan of who's doing what. Is there any like way to address the social environment in my house?
Nope. You have to go with the flow. I mean, you've explained it. That's the problem. There is no way. You know why? If your children were all the same, you know, it wouldn't be a problem. But it's a welcome problem to have, in my opinion. You know.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. I encourage you to move
thank you very
to
much.
The next session. Special thank you very much.